This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. 1 in 26 people will be diagnosed with epilepsy at some point in their lives. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, this condition, marked by seemingly random seizures, can vary from a momentary disruption of the senses to short periods of unconsciousness or staring spells to convulsions. Epilepsy is not only confusing to those who suffer from it, but to researchers, too. Now, 60 years ago, the TV series Medic premiered. For the episode on epilepsy, Dr. Conrad Steiner, played by Richard Boone, describes the view of epilepsy at that time.
An epileptic is not insane, nor is he evil as men have imagined in the past. He is possessed of a disability as logically explainable as a lame leg. But the stigma of fear lives on, a reminder of man's superstitious past. This the doctor must treat, as well as the epilepsy. The practice of medicine does not stop with the administration of a pill or the use of a knife. It must also immunize against ignorance, intolerance, and superstition. These too are forms of sickness, and the practice of medicine is directed toward health.
We know now that epilepsy is caused by electric disturbances in the brain, but even though doctors have many more treatments to choose from than they did 60 or even just 10 years ago, there's still an aura of mystery about its true cause and how to treat it. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about epilepsy, and we want to hear from you. Are you or someone you know affected by epilepsy? Coming up later, we'll be joined by New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer to discuss other mysteries of the brain. But first, I want to welcome in Dr. Erica Schuyler, who's a neurologist at Hartford Hospital, a member of the American Epilepsy Society. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
And if you have questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. First of all, maybe you can describe a bit better for us what epilepsy is.
Sure. Well, a seizure is a transient occurrence of signs or symptoms due to an abnormal or excessive synchronous neuronal activity in the brain. So basically, cells in the brain start to fire synchronously, and they're not supposed to do that. When we diagnose somebody with epilepsy, epilepsy exists in somebody who has had a seizure and whose brain, for whatever reason, there are quite a few reasons, and we can talk more about that, demonstrates an enduring tendency to continue to have seizures.
So just very quickly, if you have seizures that are epileptic seizures in the way that they normally present themselves, that doesn't necessarily mean you have epilepsy. There's other reasons why you might have a seizure, for instance.
That's correct. So it is possible to have what we call a provoked seizure. So basically anybody's brain is capable of having a seizure. And sometimes there may be a temporary condition, such as a medication reaction, an abnormality in the blood chemistries, or another reason which may make the brain likely to have a seizure. And when that provoking factor is taken away, the person's brain does not have an increased tendency towards having seizures. So in that case, somebody could have a single seizure, and it's a one-time occurrence.
If someone has multiple seizures over the course of their lives, we then assume that that would lead one to believe that epilepsy could be the cause.
Correct. So one of the basic working definitions of epilepsy is that if somebody who has had two unprovoked seizures, then they meet the criteria for being diagnosed with epilepsy. There's a newer working definition in where somebody can have a single unprovoked seizure, and when we look into the potential causes, we figure out that they do have a very high risk of having another seizure, and in that case, someone now can receive that diagnosis of epilepsy as well.
What happens during a seizure?
So there are several different types of seizures. So one of the types that we think of commonly is when somebody has a convulsion. The other names that people have used for that is a grand mal seizure, for example, or a generalized tonic-clonic seizure is one of the terms we use now. When that happens, there's a synchronous firing of cells in both hemispheres. And what that leads to is a very stereotyped appearance in which somebody has usually a gasping sound followed by stiffening of their body and then subsequently rhythmic shaking of their body. So that's what we call a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. However, there's another type of seizure in which a single focus of the brain is involved. So it could be a very small area of the brain, and we call that a focal seizure. And the symptoms that a person may experience or the signs that we may see are related to the area of the brain that is involved. So, for example, if somebody has a focal seizure involving the motor cortex on the left side of their brain, they may have involuntary rhythmic shaking of their right arm. Or, for example, if somebody has a focal seizure involving their visual cortex, they may experience hallucinations or some type of visual phenomenon, and that's the symptom they experience from their seizure. So there really is a wide range of signs and symptoms that we can see.
the danger of this larger seizure, this tonic-clonic seizure, in which someone is involuntarily gasping for air and they're shaking, they're on the ground, their limbs stiffen. This could happen anytime, unprovoked, meaning that driving, walking up and down stairs, normal everyday life could be affected. It could be incredibly dangerous for those or others around them.
That's true. When, for example, if we're trying a medication treatment and we're not sure if somebody may have a high risk of having another seizure, that is a time where we recommend taking extra precautions. For example, after someone's had a seizure, it's recommended not to drive for a period of time. And also other things that, if you think about common sense-wise, could be dangerous if one were to have a seizure. Swimming alone, taking a bath, using heavy machinery, working over an open flame. There are many activities that we really have to think about. Would this be dangerous if I were to suddenly lose consciousness?
We're talking with Dr. Erica Schuyler, who's a neurologist at Hartford Hospital and a member of the American Epilepsy Society. We're trying to find out more about this brain condition. And if you want to join us with questions or thoughts, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. In just a moment, we're going to be hearing a story from someone very close to us who's recently diagnosed with epilepsy. Before we go much further, though, when we start talking about treatment and research, what is the most interesting thing to you about this condition? What's the thing that, as someone who studies it, makes you either wake up at night or wake up in the morning saying, I want to try to figure that out?
Part of what I think is really interesting about epilepsy is, like I said, there's such a huge variety. And really the most important part is talking to the person who's had the seizure or talking to people who have witnessed the seizure to really find out a very detailed description of their experience and to put that together with the anatomy of the brain to really figure out what is happening to them.
Of course, often, you know, seizure can happen and no one's around. Mm-hmm. You don't have any witnesses. And so, therefore, it's very hard to get all that fine-grained detail that you'd probably want as a physician.
That's true. And oftentimes, it's hard to know if what happened was even a seizure. Oftentimes, what will happen is somebody will have an episode where they pass out. If nobody saw it and they woke up on the floor, we're not sure if it could have been a seizure. Could it have been related to a cardiac arrhythmia? Fainting or syncope. There are many causes that we consider in addition to seizure.
We said off the top of the program that 1 in 26 people may be diagnosed within their lifetimes. Right now, somewhere between 2 and 3 million people currently suffer from epilepsy. Do we think that that number is right from an epidemiological standpoint? I mean, do we really think we've got a grasp on the scope of the disease right now?
I think that may be an underestimate. I think that there are probably quite a few people out there who have epilepsy and they don't realize it. So it's possible to go on for several years for sometimes having unexplained events or symptoms and not come right away to a diagnosis.
Today on Where We Live, we're talking about epilepsy in the brain. In a few minutes, we're going to take some of your questions at 860-275-7266. You can also email wherewelive at wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. The reason we're having this conversation today is because someone in our Where We Live family was recently diagnosed. Producer Tucker Ives had a seizure in the newsroom just over 2 weeks ago. It was scary for everyone. Some of us had seen an epileptic seizure before. For others, it was the first time. For Tucker and his wife, Jillian, the diagnosis means a lot of changes for their lives together. Here's Tucker talking with Jillian.
How did you find out that I had a seizure?
I luckily had the day off work, so I was actually out shopping, and I got a phone call from a number I didn't know, and I just hit ignore, and they called again. So I figured if they called twice, maybe it was important. And so I picked up, and it was your boss, John. And he said, everything's fine, but Tucker had a little seizure at work today. And so they're taking him to St. Francis.
Did you freak out?
I thought I actually stayed pretty calm. Yes, I was worried, but at the same time, like, I didn't have the reaction I thought I might have been, that I might have, like, cried or been really upset, or I just was kind of shaking and drove there.
What was I like?
Well, I knew something was wrong when I walked in. You weren't entirely there. It wasn't entirely you, which also made me a little more nervous because you just smiled and, like, gave me this look of like, hey, what are you doing here? you just weren't taking it very seriously. You weren't upset. I thought you'd be mad. Like, you know, this is a waste of my time. Like, what am I doing here? I thought you would have, especially after hours and hours and hours of being in the ER, you were still just very happy when I came in and saw you. And I said, like, what happened? Are you okay? You're like, well, they just told me I had a seizure, you know? And, like, you just didn't take any of it very seriously. And you just were happy, but you asked a lot of the same questions over and over again. You had two coworkers in the room when I got there. And you told them the same story about 5 times. And
what story?
About what we think might have been the first time you had a seizure in college when you were alone in your room and you woke up with a black eye and your glasses were broken. So it was kind of similar to this of waking up, not knowing what's going on and having bruises and no glasses. And you told them that story quite a few times because I think you were thinking about it because you didn't have your glasses on and you had a big bruise. But they were really nice and like laughed and smiled each time. Like, yeah. And I was trying not to be mean, but it worried me so much that you were telling me the same thing over and over again and you didn't know what was going on. It was funny, but at the same time scary.
So we've been married less than a year. And is it the type of thing that you can prepare for, being able to communicate with doctors about someone else's health when you're also going through the emotional trauma in many ways of seeing what I just went through?
I'm really glad that I'm the emergency contact, but it's also a big responsibility of wondering every day when I let you out the door now if I'm going to get a call that, you know, they found my name on your medical bracelet and called. So it's a lot of responsibility, but I knew it was going to happen sooner or later. Just not so soon.
And for the next 3 months, it looks like you're my driver. That was probably not something you signed up for.
No, because I hate driving. And you're the driver of the relationship. Yeah, it's kind of sad, but that's definitely been the biggest strain. Not that you have to take a pill every day, twice a day now, or that you have a medical bracelet now, but that I have to drive you everywhere, or you have to take the bus. No, maybe epilepsy won't have a huge impact on our day-to-day lives in the future, but for the next 3 months, it really does change our lifestyle in ways that I didn't expect and challenge our relationship in ways I didn't expect, having to be the driver in Hartford traffic and not enjoying it.
So I guess that I think it's that impact on you that concerns me more. I am perfectly capable of taking anti-seizure medicine. But there is always that uncertainty, too. There's always that uncertainty going forward that if I have a seizure, where will I be? What will I be doing? Will I be endangering other people? Will I be endangering you? And I suppose that it's that concerns me more than the condition itself. It's not the condition. It's not having epilepsy. The doctors told me, yeah, you're probably going to be taking this medication for the rest of your life. That I can get accustomed to. That isn't a problem. But there's still that uncertainty. The medication isn't foolproof. There is still a lot of uncertainty in terms of what this means going forward, and it's almost like playing a game of Russian roulette. Is that the same concern that you have?
Yes, in a way. Obviously, my first concern is the impact epilepsy has on you with any kind of damage you do to yourself, where you are like hitting your head really hard, how you fell. It could have been much worse. And I feel bad for your coworkers because they went through that. And obviously, it's traumatizing to see someone you love, and they all love you very much, to have a seizure and, you know, then not really be cognizant of anything and not be able to talk after. And that's something I never want to see. But at the same time, it's this emotional pull of I don't ever want to see it. But at the same time, of course, I want to be there for you if it does happen. But you do have great coworkers, so I do feel a little more safe with you at work, knowing how great they responded to everything and that they probably handled it better than I would have. I would have just freaked out and not known what to do, whereas they handled it really well and they all checked in on you, took care of me, and I appreciate that about your job.
That was Jillian Ives speaking to her husband and Where We Live producer Tucker Ives. Last month, Tucker had a seizure here at WNPR and was later diagnosed with epilepsy. He's got to not do that. He scared the hell out of us. Got us thinking about this condition, which affects nearly 3 million people in the U.S. Coming up, we'll be joined by Allison Gamber, Associate Director of the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut, to talk more about living with epilepsy. Later, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer will join us to talk about the mysteries of the brain. That's coming up right after this, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about epilepsy. It's a condition that more than 150,000 Americans are diagnosed with each year. We were talking with Where We Live producer Tucker Ives a few moments ago. Tucker was recently diagnosed with epilepsy after he had a seizure here in the newsroom. It's something that is scary for those who know people who have epilepsy. We're going to try to find out a little bit more about the treatment, a little bit more about the disease with Dr. Erica Schuyler, who's a neurology specialist at Hartford Hospital, a member of the American Epilepsy Society. Also joining us right now is Allison Gamber, Associate Director of the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut. Allison, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We just heard Tucker telling his wife, Jillian, a bit about his story, and Jillian talking back to her. I'm wondering if anything about their conversation resonated with you, someone just finding out that this is a condition that they're going to have to live with.
The entire conversation was something that I experience almost daily with our clients that call the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut. So as I'm listening to their story, I was sitting here and feeling overwhelmed by it and hearing the passion in their voices about each other clearly and just nodding along saying, this is the experience most people have.
So talk about that experience that people have. This is a condition that sometimes people live with for their entire lives. Sometimes it presents itself in the middle of life out of the blue. Talk about how people deal with that differently. Maybe you can give us a sense of how the people that you are interacting with every day are dealing with this new diagnosis and how it affects their lives.
It's very much a process, almost like a grieving process, and everybody has to go through it in their own way. So what they were experiencing and feeling was very much in line with what most people feel, you know, overwhelmed, unsure, not certain what the future is going to hold. You know, she was talking very much about the next 3 months, and that's really where they are right now, is just looking at the next 3 months and getting through those 3 months and then moving forward after that. So taking life one day at a time in these small chunks so that they can better understand how to live with each other and live through this situation and moving forward.
Doctor, can you talk about that first 3 months, exactly why that's important?
Sure. Well, in the first 3 months, that's considered a higher risk time for having a recurrent seizure. And also, in terms of when treatment is initiated, if a medication was started, we don't know if it will work yet. So we really need to give it some time to see. States vary. From state to state, it varies in terms of what the driving restrictions are. In many states, it's 6 months. And in a couple of states, it's actually 1 year. That legally it is illegal to drive after having a seizure.
No, not asking you to make policy here, mm-hmm. but if you were helping people write policy up at the State House in Hartford, should it be 3 months? Should it be 6 months? Should it be a year? I mean, how much do we know in terms of putting people back on the roads?
Right. I think it's difficult to tell because every person is different, and it's hard to apply one single standard. I think one of the things that Connecticut does, which I think is useful, is that they consider on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, if somebody has been consistently having a seizure once every 6 months, it wouldn't make sense to have them drive after 3 months. But for example, if somebody has a single seizure and we have a reasonably good chance of treating it, then it may be reasonable after 3 months that it is safe to drive again. Obviously, the risk is never zero, and that was one of the things that always comes up, is that it is very uncertain and the medications are not foolproof, and it is possible to have a seizure at a later date.
And as you say, or especially early on, you're trying to tune the medication right. You're not sure exactly what medication is going to work, and from what I understand, there are a variety of different medications that potentially could be effective.
That's true.
And in that variety of medications, that's, I think, one of the things, Allison, that makes it so uncertain and so scary for people, is they literally don't know whether or not this medicine is going to work, and even the medication that works doesn't mean they're not going to have a seizure again.
Exactly, and that is part of the uncertainty and going through all these trials. And, you know, we get calls at our office about, well, my doctor put me on this medication. Is it going to work? There's no great answer to that. If you take it regularly like you're supposed to, that's your best chance of knowing if it's going to work. But there's no definitive way for us or for the doctors to say, yes, this is going to work, and no, this is not going to work, which and people want that certainty. And in epilepsy, there is no certainty.
I want to get to some phone calls at 860-275-7266. Let's quickly go to Susan in Hartford. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. Hi, Susan. Are you there? I think I've hit the wrong button. I apologize. Hi.
Hello?
Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I was calling. I'm actually an epilepsy researcher, and I know that many people are helped by medication, but about 30% of people have refractory seizures due to severe side effects or just inefficacy of the medication. And I wanted to use this show as an opportunity to mention that there is a highly effective dietary therapy for epilepsy called the ketogenic diet, which a lot of people and a lot of doctors are not really well versed in, but it helps to reduce seizures by over 50%, and over 50% of the people that try it, and in some cases, people can become completely seizure-free. It does need to be medically supervised, but it's been found that even shifting your diet, even if you're not on a ketogenic diet, can help reduce seizure frequency. And some of the shifts that you would make would be to reduce high glycemic foods, because we think that high glucose levels are something that can trigger seizures. And I'm going to send in on the Where We Live email a handout that's been done by the Charlie Foundation. They've been a big advocate of a ketogenic diet. That you're welcome to post online or share with Tucker Ives.
Well, and that's what we'll do. And Susan, thank you very much for that. And we will be posting online, WNPR.org. When we start doing research online about epilepsy, one of the first things we read about, Dr. Schuyler, is the ketogenic diet. What's Susan talking about?
So that's it's a diet that is used more often in children, actually. There have been quite a few studies showing that it can be of great help in children, especially ones who are not responding well to the medications. It does require, like she said, medical input, and there is a dietitian that's involved in the diet itself. It's a little bit trickier in older children and teenagers who may have a stronger preference towards eating certain foods and not having a restrictive diet. But it is something that is worth considering.
Of course, as she's talking through that, I can't help but thinking there's a lot in our diet that we do know and we don't know about. One of the very first things I thought when our colleague began having a seizure was, what was it that he was eating? I didn't know anything about, but I wanted to know, is something that he was eating potentially causing the problem? Do we know anything about the connection between the food we put in our body, maybe our sugar levels or anything else, and epilepsy?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important is overall lifestyle. So your brain is part of your body, and you need to treat your body well in order to help treat your epilepsy. So I think it's really important, and I talk to my patients about this in terms of eating healthy, eating regular meals, being on a routine, getting good sleep, getting exercise. All of those things that are really important for all of us, I think, are particularly important in maintaining health of the brain as well.
Allison, do you want to add anything to that? Because I think this is a big piece of this. You were talking earlier about people calling you up and saying, will the medicine that my doctor prescribed work or not? Well, as always, whenever doctors talk about health, they say, all this other stuff, you know, exercise, eat right, take care of yourself, reduce stress. We tend to forget all those other things and say, will the medicine work? So maybe you can talk about this other piece of this diet and all this other stuff.
Absolutely. It is about a lifestyle modification. And yes, the ketogenic diet can be highly effective for certain children, and it really is primarily used in children, but it doesn't work for all children. So it is an alternative treatment. It is another method of treatment. Some older children, teenagers, will use a modified Atkins diet or a low glycemic index diet. So there are alternatives to try. Again, there's no certainty that it's going to work, but definitely known triggers for epilepsy are stress, not eating properly, being well hydrated, getting enough sleep. There are, a lot of children or adults that we work with that say, if I don't get enough sleep, it's going to trigger a seizure for me.
We're going to get to some phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. And also emails are coming in, where we live at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live if you have questions about epilepsy or a personal story. I just want to get back to you, Doctor, quickly on this, though. We talk about children, and this is something I've been fascinated by, and we've done a number of programs about. We give people the right to drive a car at 16 years old. They can vote at 18 and go off to war at 18. But the more that we learn about the brain, the more we know that the brain isn't really fully formed until sometime in your mid-20s. I mean, you don't really have all the stuff that you're going to need to get you through the rest of your life until that time. So adolescence is a much longer period than we previously thought. What does any of that have to do with what we know about epilepsy? And is there a point at which, if you don't have epileptic seizures, you won't then be diagnosed with epilepsy if you're, say, past 25, 26, 30 years old?
Seizures can start at any age. There is a relative peak in early childhood because of there are quite a few causes of epilepsy that are genetic or inherited, as well as congenital or metabolic abnormalities that start right from when the brain is formed. There are also some epilepsy syndromes, which are felt to be sort of a complex genetic pattern of inheritance that can present in childhood as well as in adolescence. However, if somebody reaches 25 per se, they're not safe from ever having a seizure or epilepsy. It can happen at any age. And then in the older age, so in the elderly, that is actually one of the more common times to develop seizures as well. The causes for epilepsy in older patients is related to structural abnormalities. So, for example, strokes and brain tumors and head injuries, things that can cause the brain to have an injury and resulting in having seizures, those occur more later in life. So we start to see more epilepsies related to past stroke or brain tumor, for example, in the elderly population.
We got an email here from Daniel who says, as an epileptic diagnosed at adolescence, I don't always openly discuss or disclose my medical condition. In my experience, I see a lot of worry, nervousness, and fear from a range of people to whom I do disclose it to. I completely understand Tucker's uncertainty and concern. Medication can help with physical symptoms, but at times it feels like the social stigma never dissipates. And I know that we touched on this at the beginning of the program, playing those clips from 60 years ago, an old television show that hints at even a longer ago bias against epilepsy, that indeed it was a possession by a demon. It's something that is very scary to see. Allison, what can you talk about around the stigma around it, how it impacts people, and how to get past some of that?
Well, that email actually was right on spot, and that's how a lot of people feel. We encourage people to talk about it, but then the reality is that people will look at you like, oh, when are you going to have a seizure? What do I do? Are you going to be okay? So talking about it is great. So it makes people aware of it. And certainly in how to help somebody when they're having a seizure is key, because that will alleviate the person with epilepsy, their fears in being around those people. But it is a very uncertain thing for people to talk about. Even today, I think it's gotten a little bit better in the public's eye. We're not at a great place yet, but I feel like we're making baby steps towards people understanding better and being more accepting of it.
Let's go to Shelley, who is calling from Canton. Hi there, Shelley. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. I was diagnosed with epilepsy at the age of 13, and I'm now 63. So I've managed this as a preteen, as an adolescent, as a young adult, and now kind of as a senior. And I have to say, I had a doctor when I was diagnosed who gave me, I think, the best phrase of anybody. He told me, you are the same person today as you were the day before you had your first seizure. Yes, you have something you need to be careful about. You need to have good medical management. You need to be vigilant, take your medications. but you're still the same person. And I've kept that thought with me all these 50 years because I think that's very true.
Shelley, quickly before I let you go, and I do appreciate you sharing your story, how have the loved ones around you, the people that you are most close to, how have they dealt with this? How have they helped you along the way? Because as we've suggested, it can be something that's a little scary to people. It can be something that outsiders who don't suffer themselves don't exactly know how to deal with.
Well, I think the big key for me is that I've never been very secretive about it. I'm a pretty open person. So my family, my children, my husband, you know, my relatives, my close friends, you know, they know that this is a situation that I've been dealing with for years. You know, I've been very fortunate that I've been seizure-free for a long time. I have wonderful medical follow-up, and I'm very vigilant about that. But I also know that I'm walking a line, and so do they. They know what to do if something happens. I think that's the thing that reassures them. And they also know that, you know, in more, you know, the strong likelihood of me getting severely hurt is small.
Mm. Well, Shelley, first of all, thank you again very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I want to go to John, who's in Woodbury. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was diagnosed with epilepsy about 4 years ago. I'm 63. The loss of memory started after I had had open-heart surgery. Many people who have had open-heart surgery are afflicted with what's called pump head. This is not really something that's talked about in the medical field. But it's a very real thing. There's been many, there's been much research that's been done on this. I lost total memory after the surgery. Since then, I have bouts of short-term memory loss. I was diagnosed with the epilepsy 4 years ago. Before that, I had had quite a few what they call mini mals, but I didn't know that. It really wasn't until I had the grand mal that I understood that I had epilepsy. And it comes back. I have not had a grand mal in a couple of years, but I have many of the mini mals. They can come whenever. They're not debilitating, but they're, well, I see them as a nuisance. My wife sees them as much more than that.
Mm. Well, John, thank you very much for your phone call and your story. I want to get a few thoughts from Dr. Schuyler here, listening to what John had to say and our previous caller before that.
One of the things that stood out was how he mentioned that he had quite a few smaller seizures before he was diagnosed, and it really took having that big convulsion for what his symptoms he was having to be recognized as epilepsy. So I think that happens a lot of the time, particularly in somebody who is an older adult who has never had seizures before. And so this is a relatively new symptom. So I think that's something to kind of keep your eye out for, I guess, if somebody is having episodes where they're briefly not as responsive or having periods where they're losing some time, that it's something worth checking out and looking into in more detail.
And I'm wondering if you can talk more about how this all ties into things like memory loss or other neurological conditions. It seems, again, from a layman's perspective, that whatever sort of electrical storm in your brain causes an epileptic seizure, it can't be good for your brain to have too many of those things. So I guess my first question is having to do with short or long-term memory loss. The second is there neurological damage, short or long-term, from having repeated seizures?
Sure. So I'll address the first part. So in terms of memory loss, memory decline can be a problem, particularly in patients who have temporal lobe epilepsy. So that is a common type of epilepsy in adults. And the area of the brain called the hippocampus is located in the temporal lobe, and that is an area of the brain that's important for processing memories. So if somebody has something wrong with their temporal lobe, oftentimes a structural lesion or something else that's causing them to have seizures, oftentimes they have memory problems as well. And in terms of having a lot of seizures over time, it is felt that that could contribute to the decline in that function.
I wonder, Allison, if you could add anything to that, because, again, I think these are some of the questions that people have as they or loved ones are diagnosed.
Certainly, especially with the memory and the medications as well. Some of the side effects from the medications is memory impairment. So that, and along in conjunction with the location of the seizure activity, can all play a role in that. And we see a lot of that in our children. And the adults that I talk to, they'll just tell me, oh, my memory is just not good anymore. And it is, again, due to the medications and the seizure type.
Before we take a break, just two quick questions. One came in from Iris, who called us and couldn't stay. And another question that is not connected, but I want to tick these two off here. Connections between seizures and migraines, why people with migraines are sometimes prescribed anti-seizure medication. Can you quickly address that?
Sure. Migraine medications run the gamut. So many migraine medications were medications used for something else that were found to have benefit in migrainers. So, for example, there are many high blood pressure medicines, anticonvulsants or anti-seizure medications, and as well as antidepressant medications, which are all commonly prescribed to treat migraines.
And secondly, any correlation at all with concussions? We hear a lot about traumatic brain injury these days in football, in the military. Do we know anything about whether or not concussions can have any impact on causing epilepsy?
So fortunately, the average, you know, mild sports concussions that I'll bet most children undergo at some point in their life have not been shown to really afford a extremely high risk of epilepsy. However, more severe head injuries, such as a head injury where there's been loss of consciousness for more than a couple of minutes, head injuries where there's involved a skull fracture or bleeding in the brain, those are types of head injuries which are definitely associated with a higher risk of developing what we call post-traumatic epilepsy.
We're talking about epilepsy today. It's a neurological condition that scientists are starting to get a better grasp on, but it still remains mysterious. Coming up, we'll be talking about some new brain research with New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, for several months now, the political crisis in Ukraine has resulted in economic sanctions, plenty of threats in both directions, and ongoing violence. Ukrainians are supposed to go to the polls to elect a new president later this month. Coming up, we'll talk to a local professor who will go to Ukraine to act as an elections monitor. It's one of the stories we'll be covering tomorrow on Where We Live. I hope that you can join us. Today, we're talking about the neurological condition known as epilepsy. Despite all the scientific advances we've made throughout history, the brain still remains a mystery, not just in this condition, but in many other ways. We're going to take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're joined in studio by Dr. Erica Schuyler, who's a neurologist at Hartford Hospital and a member of the American Epilepsy Society, and Allison Gamber, who's associate director of the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut. I want to bring into the conversation Carl Zimmer. He's a science writer and columnist for the New York Times. He wrote a big cover piece for National Geographic in February, The New Science of the Brain, and there is a lot of new science right now. Carl Zimmer, welcome back to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
But before we get into some of the bigger ideas about what we're learning about the brain, we're having this conversation about epilepsy. It strikes me that this is one of these many confounding things that physicians have learned so much more about. We know more about how to treat it, but yet we still don't really know where it comes from, why exactly people develop it. It seems as though, Carl, this is just one of the many mysteries that we can't seem to get our arms around right now.
It's true. I mean, epilepsy and other brain disorders really are challenging scientists with their incredible complexity. I mean, the issue is that we're dealing with the brain, which is a structure that's got maybe 80 or 90 billion neurons that are forming many trillions of connections, and the complexity of that network makes it very hard to study, but incredibly, you know, scientists are starting to get their arms around this problem and trying to see the brain as this gigantic network and a network that has these interesting properties. And sometimes when the network goes awry, you may end up with situations like an epileptic seizure.
Maybe you can tell us from some of the work that you've been doing what the real new is in the world of brain research. When we look at this network and all this white matter tying together all this gray matter, what are the new things that we're finding out about how the brain works that have been surprising to you, Carl?
To begin with, the technology itself is pretty stunning. I mean, it really just wasn't possible to look at the brain in the big picture before. I mean, scientists would be able to zero in on, a small patch of tissue and eavesdrop on the neurons there, or they might be able to take a big X-ray that really didn't show you very much in the whole brain. But now we have these pictures, as it were, of the brain where you're actually seeing millions upon millions of connections, and you can follow them out. And what scientists are finding is that there is a rich, fascinating structure to those connections. It's a little bit like the internet, where you have hubs and spokes, and so a signal on one side of your brain goes through these kind of relay stations, as it were, to get to other parts of the brain. And so you can actually use the mathematics that mathematicians have developed for studying networks to start to understand how our brain works.
Hmm. I want to bring back in Dr. Erica Schuyler, because as we run low on time for our conversation, I want to hear a little bit about some of the research that you and your colleagues are doing into epilepsy right now. I mean, what are we learning about the brain from what you're studying?
So there is a lot of interesting research going on in epilepsy right now. A couple of the topics. One is genetics. There have been some major undertakings to decipher some of the genetic causes of epilepsy. And there has been a lot of advances in sequencing, and the whole goal of somewhere down the road we'll have this precision medicine where treatments are developed to target specific genetic findings. So that's something I think would be wonderful. There are also several devices, for example, the responsive neurostimulator. So devices that can be developed where a seizure can be detected directly from the surface of the brain, and detected by an implanted device, and then sort of zapped to stop it before the patient actually goes into having a seizure.
My goodness. So how far away are we to that actually being in use?
So there is a device that is underway in clinical trials that does exactly that. So some interesting things coming down the pipeline. And then the last thing, we talked a little bit about head injuries causing seizures. So if, the idea of epileptogenesis, so that's the process by which normal brain cells develop a tendency to become seizure prone. So there's a lot of research, animal research, cell culture research, looking at what is that process and how can we target therapies to prevent people from developing epilepsy in the first place. The medications that we have right now are really medications that help prevent seizures but don't target the cause of developing seizures. So.
I want to get to a few quick phone calls here, as a lot of people want to join us. Valerie's in Woodbury. Hi, Valerie. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You spoke earlier of some cognitive impairment, memory loss following repeated seizure, and we hear so much about neuroplasticity these days. I wonder what research is out there to show what possibility there is of improving cognition, functional improvement, memory improvement, and if you have any specific sources for contacts that we can find to help people we know with epilepsy improve.
Valerie, thank you very much. Doctor?
So part of the assessment of patients with epilepsy, particularly patients who are in the group that continue to have seizures despite medications, is that we do a lot of detailed neuropsychological testing. So we do have patients undergo a more detailed description of their cognitive function with the goal of sort of targeting what can we do about that. So that's definitely an important part of it. There's definitely, it's a very active area of research going on, looking at neurorehabilitation with seizures, as well as things like with strokes. After strokes, how do we rebuild? How do we regain function? So it's definitely a hot area of research right now.
Carl Zimmer, when our caller says neuroplasticity, something we read a lot about, what is she talking about?
Well, it has to do with how our neurons are actually very dynamic. There was an old idea that, once you became an adult, basically your brain is just kind of locked in to its anatomy and its connections, and that's not really the case anymore. We know now that actually our brains are making new connections throughout life. We actually can produce completely new neurons in a few parts of the brain, and so to understand how plastic, in other words, how malleable the brain is, could lead to new kinds of treatments for epilepsy and a lot of other disorders as well. It's a new way of thinking about our brains.
When we talk about the brains, President Obama has unveiled this brain initiative. It's something that theoretically will teach us a lot more about how the brain works. What do you think the outcomes, Carl, have been so far, and what do you see as the potential outcomes for this initiative at the federal level?
Well, the Brain Initiative was launched just about a year ago, a little over a year ago now, and so really the scientists have spent the past year just trying to figure out what would be the right kind of road to follow in terms of a massive, nationally coordinated project. and the focus is really zeroing in on these tools I mentioned, tools like developing ways of turning on and off certain circuits in the brain individually. And scientists want to do that to figure out what those circuits are doing when they're turned on, but also this could eventually lead to new kinds of treatments, because if you had a drug that only went after a certain very specific type of neurons, you might be able to really effectively treat disorders like epilepsy.
Carl Zimmer is a science writer and columnist for the New York Times. He also wrote this big front page article in National Geographic, The New Science of the Brain. It uses infographics as well as almost any story I've ever read to explain what we know about how the brain's working today. Carl Zimmer, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us here on Where We Live.
Thank you.
Before we go, I want to get to one quick phone call. Dan is in Danbury. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious if Dr. Schuyler would comment on some of the intriguing research on the use of a medicine called levetiracetam, or Keppra, as it commonly known, in its role in memory disorders, in particular Alzheimer's disease.
Well, and Dan, I'm going to leave it at that just because we're low on time. Doctor?
I don't know as much about the treatment of Alzheimer's with levetiracetam. However, that is a very common and widely prescribed medication that has helped benefit a lot of people with seizures. It's one of the medications of the 20-plus in our armamentarium that is commonly used.
A lot of information still to give out in just the last couple of minutes here. So I'll go to you first, Doctor. If people want to find out more about the work that you do, I know that you have a phone number here and you also have a website, but what should you tell people who want to know more about epilepsy or how to treat it?
Sure. Well, I would recommend taking a look at our website. So I work at the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center at Hartford Hospital. We have a website with a lot of information and links there. And I'm sure Allison will give you her information as well. The Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut, we've collaborated with, we have a great relationship with, and they offer great services. Our website is...
I'll give it right now. Okay. It's harthosp.org, harthosp.org/epilepsy. And there's a phone number, 860-545-3621. We'll be putting more information on our website, WNPR.org. And Allison, how about you? Maybe you can tell people how to get in touch with your organization.
Certainly. Well, we're the Epilepsy Foundation of Connecticut, and we also have a website. It's epilepsyct.com, and we have epilepsy information and links to various resources throughout the state of Connecticut, including Hartford Hospital and their Comprehensive Epilepsy Center. And our phone number is 1-800-899-3745.
And you'd be a place to go if people just want basic information. They want to learn what to do next. They want to know the sort of things that we wanted to know after one of our coworkers had a seizure in the office.
Exactly. We're the place to go after you leave the doctor's office and you go home and you have this list of questions that you're not sure how to answer. If you should be calling the doctor. So call us. We're here to bounce ideas off of.
And also, you have an event coming up very, very soon.
We do. We have our 10th annual Sharon's Ride, Run, Walk for Epilepsy this Saturday, May 10th. At Old Grove at Savin Rock in West Haven, Connecticut, and all of our information is on our website.
All the information is on the website. Thank you both so very much for coming in and for giving us some more information. Allison Gamber and Dr. Erica Schuyler, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank Eldon Thomas for helping us with the phones today. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, and the executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.